Welcome to the Continued Silence with me, Emma Jane Taylor, here on UK Health Radio. The Continued Silence is focused on the very uncomfortable conversations of child sex abuse and the importance of talking openly about this subject to try and normalise the conversation. Child sex abuse is real. It affects millions of people, young and old, across the world. The work we are doing is very much engaging more lateral thought processes on this terrible crime, supporting survivors, protecting children, and helping those not wanting to listen. Joining me each show is my resident panel, therapist Denny Corby, activist Chris Tuck, and usually Michael Boughton, my resident poet, but he can't be with us today. We look forward to seeing him next time. Each week, we are going to be joined by guests, or we are joined by guests from around the world to share more insights on this really crippling conversation for many. So this month, we are joined by Jane Lipstein and Carol Brooks. Great to have you both with us today. Thank you very much for coming on the show. Before I come to my guests, I want to come to Denny because we are talking about child sex abuse today, sibling sex abuse especially, and parenting. You know, this is, you know, a very layered, complex conversation, I know. But a show that I feel will again really lift the roof or lift the lid on these difficult conversations.
Yeah, nice to be here again, Emma Jane. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the purpose of these conversations is to raise awareness, isn't it? But around sibling sexual abuse and the kind of complexities around parenting, how it's reported, the knowledge of this going on in the family is it's about conversations, awareness, prevention, protection, education. We know that sibling sexual abuse is believed to be the most common form of sexual abuse within the home. An expert suggests it's three times more likely than adult child sexual abuse from a parent or a caregiver. And yet, it's rarely spoken about, it's rarely reported. And I had to scrabble around for literature. Thank you, Jane Epstein and Carol, because yours came up straight away. So we know it's often abuse also over a much longer period of time because the victim's far more available. There's more periods of time within that family that they're available. I think it's really interesting also that when you look at prevention and protection and reporting, it's really important to hang on to the fact that experts believe 95 to 98% of young offenders do not go on to be adult offenders. So that's where we have to run a parallel track. We have to run this parallel track of understanding what the barriers are around reporting awareness, how professionals and parents deal with sibling sexual abuse. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation. As always, my ears are pinned back to people who have expertise and specialism within the area.
Absolutely. It's really interesting, isn't it? Sort of just listening to you talk there about, you know, often sibling sexual abusers don't go on to be offenders and paedophiles into their adult life. And I find that's something that I feel is really interesting to this conversation. And also, why is that? Why is that? And I suppose this is where Jane and Carol come into the conversation to, you know, in light, you know, in educate us on more of this conversation. And like you say, there wasn't really much information. There's not a lot of information. There's not a lot of people talking about it. So when we do have experts in on this show, it's great for us to get as educated as we can. So thank you, Carol and Jane. I'm going to come to you first, Jane. So you know, you have worked with us before here on UK Health Radio. It's great for us to have you back again on this conversation. And this show is very much about parenting. So, but before we get to the core of the conversation, just sort of to go back to what I was just saying there, but you know, on the back of what Denny was saying, you know, for you know, child sex abusers or sibling sexual abusers. The knowledge is that they have they don't often go on to become abusers. What are the facts and research behind this?
First of all, I would like to say thank you again for having myself and Carol Brooks. She's one of my favorite advocates out there. So thank you for having us back on the show. First of all, I am not a counselor. I am not a coach. I am not a professional. So I can defer to what I've been able to read and understand. And I know that Carol has some important information on this as well. So what I've been able to understand is that generally children who sexually abuse or harm another child the age from 10 to 14, when they're entering puberty, their bodies are changing, their brains are changing. They have a lot of questions, and they may not feel safe coming to a parent to ask the questions. And in my experience, from hearing those who've caused harm and survivors, sometimes it can start as curiosity. And actually, my story started out curiosity and led to abuse. And I'm finally at a point in my life where I can say it wasn't abuse, but that's part of my healing journey. And then hearing from those who have abused or traumatized, I've heard many of them reach out to me and say, I didn't understand the damage I was causing. So I feel like these teenagers, these preteens, deserve to be educated and understand that yes, you have questions, but don't go to the internet, don't go watch pornography, and understand that you are at risk of harming another child, a cousin, and sibling. And they say that their prefrontal cortex is not fully developed, so they aren't behaving from an adult's perspective. They are behaving from a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old's perspective who has possibly been exposed to pornography or sexually abused themselves. And with counseling and help and therapy, 95 to 98% do not go on to reoffend or harm.
Jane, you mentioned something there. Are you comfortable to discuss this about you say you don't believe your abuse was abuse. Could you elaborate on that to help us understand what you mean
Sure.
by that?
Sure. I identified as having been sexually abused for a very long time. And I think it's part of my healing process. It's where I am in my healing. And then I realized, well, it was more a trauma response. Carol and I have very different stories, very different stories. And then now that I'm moving on out of survivor mode, I'm feeling like now I can say that that was something that happened in my life. I think a lot of it has to do with where I am in my healing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a great deal of sense to me. It's just the first time I've ever heard someone speak in that way, Denny. And I don't know if you've ever heard someone sort of share that part of their abuse journey that they feel like they've moved on from sexually abused trauma response to now a part of their life. And I do relate to that in many ways, but it's just interesting hearing someone talk about it.
I think from my point of view, Emma Jane, is that I have heard that before. And I think what Jane has just highlighted is that every single individual will deal with and heal and process things very, very differently. And that's okay, because we can run the risk sometimes of kind of enforcing that label upon people. And I know that I'm very happy to disclose that for me, the term sexual abuse took me years to get my head around. And for me, part of my healing and understanding in way back 15, 20 years ago was around I needed to have it in a way that sat well with me in order for me to look at it. So for me, it was inappropriate behavior, sat much better for me in my brain, how I resonated. And then that enabled me to lean in and kind of look. So it's really important that we honor and acknowledge that every single individual has their own process with this.
And I think it's great. I mean, I think it's really, truly great to be able to have that spin on it yourself, and it's something that I can really relate to, I suppose. I guess I've always identified it as a survivor of child sex abuse, and I use that as a title to help me with with my work, my advocacy, my writing, because even though I do feel very much removed from that person now as a 50-year-old woman, it's something that I know that I've used. But it's really interesting. Jane, thank you very much for sharing that with us. So just going to stay with you, Jane, because obviously today it's about parenting, and obviously child sex abuse, sibling sexual abuse, and the responsibilities of parents. And so just sort of staying with you before we go on to Carol there, what would you like to highlight on this conversation that you feel parents could engage better or support more with?
Well, I know before we got on, I think Carol had something really important to say regarding that. So I'm going to let her state that. I think the first thing is that parents, when you are talking to our children about stranger danger, let's include siblings, let's include older adolescents, let's include stepchildren, and don't brush that under the rug. And I think it was Denise who stated something before we started recording as well. And this is something I hate to be, negative, but instead of approaching a situation as kids will be curious, it's harmless, we should approach it as an opportunity. If we run into something, if we sense something as a parent, use that as an opportunity to talk to your children, educate your children. Don't just assume it's harmless. And something that I've heard from a lot of parents is instincts. Something in their gut told them something was off, but they didn't know what. And I'm a parent, and I would strongly suggest listen to those instincts. You may not know what they're saying, but listen to them and use that as an opportunity to talk to your children. And don't just brush this under the rug.
Yeah, I think we've lost Jane there. But instincts. I'm going to come to you, Chris, before we go to Carol. Instincts, something that obviously is an important part of parenting anyway. Now we're in the 21st century, and these conversations, even though they are very suppressed, and think don't often occur in people's lives. I would like to think instinct has become much more prevalent in parenting conversations.
Ooh, I believe as a survivor, because of what I went through, I have got good gut instinct as to what people are like when they're in my space, and I can read them quite well. But I do know there are many parents that are not exposed to this in any way, shape, or form. They don't want to believe it's happening. They're in their little bubble and they couldn't even bear thinking about anything like this to happen. So I don't believe that their gut instinct would even lead them to thinking like that because they've got no experience of it and they don't want to go there. That's my opinion. Do I believe that every parent should be aware? They should have that gut instinct? Yeah, but if it isn't in your everyday life, why would you want to think about something so abhorrent?
Actually, as parents, you're all parents and you've all got a huge instinct because of what you've gone through as children, what is what Chris is saying. The instinct has come from previous trauma and her role now and all of your roles now as parents to ensure that doesn't happen with your children. And I don't know about you, Chris. I speak all the time, as you do, and everybody here in this room does. But I find it's the people come to me when after the horse has bolted so much, saying, "I wish I'd leaned in sooner and listened to you before my child was abused by my husband or the friend around the corner or da 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 da." Why is it? And I guess this is a million-dollar question. Is it because it seems so unreal that this could even happen to a child that that's why people don't want to live that way? Or are people just in La La Land and they just want to live, some kind of Disney kind of life?
I just truly believe that people are just not aware. If they've never come across this in any way, shape, or form, it's just not in their realm of thinking. Because why would it be? I wouldn't want to think about all of this stuff if I hadn't been shown it in my lifetime, but at the same time, now that we do know different, us here, we make it our life's mission to raise that awareness to please be aware that this could happen. Because if you're aware it could happen, you're in a better space to help and support any child that's going to come forward and potentially disclose or not, but show up in a way that they're not happy and something's happening to them. And then you can, if you're aware, you can do something about it.
Do you think then, Chris, I'm just thinking out loud now as you're talking, obviously you're very focused on child sex abuse as a parent to ensure that doesn't happen to your boys. Are you acutely aware of knife crime and all the other crimes around you that children are getting dragged into often at schools and social media?
So I am aware of all of that, but my focus is not that. My focus is child sexual abuse, purely because it takes so much out of you. If you were invested in every single area,
No,
you
but I
just
mean
can't do it.
as a parent, not as an activist, but as a parent, obviously, having gone through previous trauma, you want to make sure your children don't go through any experiences that you did. But with so much going on, do you also talk to your children about the stuff that we see in the news, knife crimes, social media,
Absolutely.
bullying, trauma? Don't you? So you soak all that up as well, because obviously your own trauma, but you're also, worldly aware that this stuff can affect your kids. And is that because you're a parent who believes it's the right thing to do? Or do you think it's still, again, because of the trauma you've gone through, you are much more aware of and lateral risks attached?
That lateral risks attached, but also the where I was brought up, where I live, my environment, and just the ch protection of my children, teaching them how to keep safe, and just discussing with them scenarios potentially that would make them unsafe so that I can keep them safe. So if they're aware of stuff, you can't protect them from everything, but I think you can educate them and make them aware of what potentially could go wrong. But at the same time, you don't want to give them too much of the world is a really dangerous place. Otherwise, you're going to create a nervous wreck as a child. You want them to grow up to be, thinking that they can be loved and they can trust and they can achieve all of that in a safe way. But the world is a dangerous place, and I think as long as you do speak to them, but on a level of hopefully this will turn out all okay, but please be aware that of these dangers, and this is how you could protect yourself better. Or if you can't protect yourself, because it's the onus should not be on them, it's the perpetrator that causes the damage and the harm, but I'm here for anything that goes on with you. Come to me and I will help and support you through it. I think that's the role of the parent in my eyes in these situations, is don't ever dumb down or numb down what is being told to you or shared with you. Accept what is being told to you at face value and then get the help and support that is needed. Don't brush it under the carpet because that's where all the damage is done.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, really interesting conversation already. Carol, welcome to today's show. You've obviously we've sort of 15 minutes, 16 minutes into the show already. What are your thoughts to what we've already spoken about?
First of all, Emma Jane, thank you so much for hosting this difficult conversation today. This is a conversation that really, really needs to be had, so thank you for hosting it. There's been some really interesting comments already so far, and I'd like to touch on a few of them. So Denise mentioned that this is the biggest form of child sexual abuse in the home, and we know it is. The research proves that it really is. I think there's two things that we really need to focus on today. Is that one aspect is education, and the other aspect is not being in denial. So the we can tell parents, I think the biggest service we can do to parents is tell them where the danger lies. And it's the bogeyman and it's the stranger danger, and it and a lot has changed to inform parents of where danger lies, but very little has been done to inform them that actually the biggest form of child sexual abuse in the home can be perpetrated by a child. And that is something that, first of all, as Chris just alluded to, we really don't want to scare children. We don't want to be scared ourselves by this idea that children can abuse. But ultimately, we can't protect our children if we don't know where the danger lies.
and if we don't pass on the sufficient care to our children. So I think it's a message that I really, really want to drum home for parents to be aware that when they think they've got children upstairs playing while they're preparing dinner, it's a very frequent opportunity for sibling sexual abuse to occur when parents are in the home. And
Would you
that seems something like
that
so.
would you at that point, Carol, say that there may well have been some instinctive feelings for you to go and check up on that child? Or do you say that regardless of instinct, you should always keep a bigger eye out on these conversations?
I think it's very, very normal for all families to have children that have friends around and they go into their room and they play. And it could be in the garden or go to the beach, go to the woods, wherever. Sibling sexual abuse is an opportunistic form of abuse. It happens whenever they have the chance. Now, that might be in the bedroom and or you know, it could be in the living room or the parents in the kitchen. It could be absolutely anywhere. So I think when it happens, most parents don't have the instinct that it's happening. When it happens time and time and time and time again, and and then there's maybe a fraction of a suspicion, then I think the instinct kicks in. And that brings me to my second point that I want to make. When parents suspect that something is going on, it's a really, really awful thing to have to face. So we can try very hard to play things down. Oh, it can't be that bad. Oh, it won't be, it's just kids playing or whatever we like to tell ourselves. But another message I'd like to put out there for parents listening is that if you suspect that there is any form of something fishy going on sexually, or between your child and another child that you know, then if you bury your head in the sand and you do not face it today, it is absolutely, if it is child abuse that's going on, it will absolutely come back and haunt you in years to come. And it will then destroy your family because sibling sexual abuse destroys homes. And the best way of it not destroying a family is one, by absolutely acknowledging that it's happening here and now, and we need to face it now. And secondly, by support being put in place to support the whole family, which is very, very rare at the moment. Only Restorative Justice Scotland is working to put in place a support network for the whole family. Otherwise, it is just for the perpetrator and the survivor. But the devastation for the family, I really can't stress it enough. It absolutely destroys families and it has to be nipped in the bud. It really is the best way of dealing with the problem.
Denise, some really interesting things there, Denny. Restorative justice for the family. Obviously, this will be something you've come across, I'm sure, many times. Is this something what, you haven't come across sibling sexual abuse recently, I think you said last time, but you have worked with someone
I've come
before.
across times, but not actually in my. I've
Not
never
into
had
your therapy, not into
those.
your room. So,
Yeah.
restorative justice, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's crucial in this. You know, when I worked at the youth offending team and I was AIM trained, which is about assessment and risk and planning, we have to look at sibling sexual abuse from the harm's point of view and the harmer. That is the only way that we are going to. And I know that's after the event has happened. So for me, there's the early intervention and there's all the what we're talking about, parental responsibility and not seeing us or our family as everyone else is out there. There's some otherness. It doesn't happen to us, it happens to these people out there. We kind of have that divide. But restorative justice is, I mean, true restorative justice is, I have harmed you. How can I repair that harm? And that's not easy. That's not easy when there's many harms within a family. You know, it splinters a family. But what we can agree on, I think, and be very certain about is that both children need protection, support, education and a risk assessment around. And there's the dilemma, because there's a lot of sibling guilt, I think, sometimes for parents. It's like, which child do I help? Which child needs the protection? Which help needs the information? And I think sometimes when we use words, we had a discussion, didn't we, before, when we use words that are, language is really important. If we push parents into a wall where they feel shame or they feel judged initially, this is about a wraparound support for the whole family. We have to have that. We have to have the whole family who feel central to any support that comes in from professionals. And it's heartbreaking. That means removing siblings sometimes, you know, removing because that protection is needed. It's just, it's absolutely huge. And that's why we're going down the parallel track, aren't we? How can we stop this from happening so frequently? And when it does happen, how can we ensure that there is A, reporting, but B, good, effective management for the family and everyone involved?
I was muted. Thank you, Denny. We're going to take a short break. Please don't go anywhere, and we will be back after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to today's show. I'm joined by Jane Epstein and Carol Brooks, and my panel, Chris Tuck and Denny Corby. We are talking about sibling sexual abuse and parenting. Such a big conversation. And if you've joined us already, then I'm sure you'll have found it as interesting as I have. It's such a big conversation. There's so much to take on board. So welcome back. I'm going to come to you, Jane. Carol was talking there about education, denial, restorative justice. You know, we look at the danger lying with the bogeyman, and we should be looking much more within our own four walls at what's going on. Of course, you know, we don't want to scare people and think every child is a sexual abuser and every child is going to, you know, sexually abuse their sibling. But what can you do to help prevent that? Do you, you know, like I said before, and I was talking to Chris, quite often people, you know, come to me after the horse is bolted, or I'm sure to Chris and you guys, but let's not wait until the horse is bolted. So how can you wrap an education around your family early enough that isn't scary, that isn't, you know, going to make everybody feel uncomfortable and awkward, but enough to make them feel supported, educated, listened to and heard?
Wow. I think, you know, parents are becoming more aware, and they are educating their children when they're 2 and 3 about using the proper terms for body parts and their right to say no and their boundaries. And it is ultimately up to the parents to protect the children. It's not up to the child who was abused to protect themselves. It's up to us parents. In my brain, I think it's just not that hard when you're talking about possibly an uncle or a coach or someone touching you inappropriately. It's not that difficult to incorporate the language of siblings, step siblings, older adolescents. I don't think it's that hard. However, I have heard from parents who were survivors of sibling sexual abuse, and they were on high alert in their own families, and it still happened. So I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's certainly more difficult to protect our children and educate our children if we aren't talking about it. People are starting to talk about it. I know that there's Consent Parenting on Instagram. She's got a lot of great information. She's starting to incorporate sibling and an older adolescent, Mama Bear. People are finally starting to talk about it and incorporate it. But you go to a parenting summit, these summits, and they have all these speakers on how to not raise a racist child and how to raise a resourceful child. But I don't see anything on there about sibling sexual abuse and trauma, yet it is part of the parenting. Now, granted, if you have a summit, it's not like parents are going to race and sign up for, oh, sign me up for sibling sexual abuse in my home, because they don't want to think about it.
And that's a big issue, right? People don't want to think about it. It's the same with child sex abuse. People don't want to think about it. So, Chris, I'm going to come to you. Introducing the conversation that your loved one could harm you is not an easy conversation, whether it's your friend to your family, the loved ones in the family, your relation, and also siblings and step sibling and step siblings, as Jane was saying. So, introducing those conversations to your children in a way that, like I said, isn't scary, isn't frightening, isn't damning everybody. It's a very delicate conversation to have, but an essential one to protect. So, with your activist head on, what would you advise people, or just listening to this conversation now, how would you handle this?
So my children, a boy and a girl, are both grown up now. It was really important to me to open that pathway gateway for them to be able to come to me and tell me anything. Talk to me about secrets. Has anyone asked you to keep a secret? Has anyone made you feel uncomfortable? What does that word uncomfortable mean for me to my children? So your body is yours. So even when I washed my children, even from a young age, I would give them the flannel and I would say, right, wash here, wash there, and I would show them on my own body. I was fully clothed, but I would show them on my own body, wash this bit, wash that bit. Oh, these are your private areas. If anyone, and over time, if anyone touches you here and you feel uncomfortable about that for what any reason, for whatever reason, if someone gives you a kiss on the cheek and you don't want them, you can say no. So again, it was age appropriate and it was repeated different times. It was bath time, it was bedtime, it was just, in everyday kind of scenarios that I would say to them in different ways, that's your body. If anyone does anything to make you feel uncomfortable, then you come to mum, you tell mum, and then we will, deal with that together. That's how I've always spoken to my children and brought my children up. Was that because of what I went through? Yeah, probably. But for me, it's always been about body autonomy. Now, my children wouldn't know what these words mean, but for me, it's always been about body autonomy and showing them that they have the right over their own body. If anyone goes into that space, then they are to talk to me about it.
Jane, just listening to Chris there, that all makes sense to me. Is there anything you feel you would add to this conversation?
I had something in my brain and
Oh,
it's left me.
don't worry. We'll come to Carol.
Oh, I
Carol,
know, I know,
is there?
I know what I was going to
Okay,
say.
go.
May I go back? If you're a parent and you're listening to this and you're thinking that would never happen in my home, I've educated my children, just try and think how you don't, as a parent. I'm a parent and I have two teen boys, and as far as I know, nothing has happened to them. But I hear from parents, and it is devastating to parents. They have to go through, do I report the child? Do I have to choose one child? Do I have to remove one child? It's horrific. And sometimes children are removed, and then they actually change, it changes the relationship with the grandparents. It's devastating. So if you think you can avoid that, talk to your children. pay attention, incorporate that into your brain as much as we don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about my kids ever having brain cancer, and I can't prevent that. This is something that we can actually
do something about. We can do something about this. And I think, you know, that's why we're doing these shows, is we can do something about educate parents to educate their children. Carol, you had your hand up there. Is there anything you want to add to that conversation, Carol?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Right. Sorry. What I'd like to add is that sibling sexual abuse, the duration tends to be on average quite a few years. So it's not like it's a one-off that somebody touches them, like it might be somebody outside the home. When it's in the home, and that could be a cousin or somebody who visits the home regularly, that's under the bracket of sibling sexual abuse. It tends to happen over a long period of time. Now, during that time, there are multiple opportunities where somebody might walk in the room. Now, in my personal case, we were walked in on many times, and once by my stepmom. So I think most of the cases that people I've spoken to, when someone walked in the room, the situation was ignored, or the parent accepted an excuse that, in my opinion, the parents must have doubted that was really, that they must have thought that was a lie. So my advice would really be that, yes, it's great to explain body parts and body autonomy, great. But the other thing to do is, if a parent ever stumbles upon something that just really feels like, whether it's a child pulling their knickers up or they're looking at something. I mean, some parent, there's an incident of someone that I work with where the parent walked in the room and the siblings weren't even together. They were standing in the same room, but they weren't walking in upon an act, but they knew that something was wrong. So my absolute advice would be delve, and do not accept, oh, we were just playing, or an excuse. And if that is the only thing you can get out of them, then next time they're around, check in the room, pop in the room, just don't dismiss it. Just keep pursuing it. Keep your eye on it, because the chances are, the statistics the way they are, the chances are you've stumbled upon it and you can help stop it.
And Jane has previously said that her father walked in one time and turned around and walked out. I can't imagine anything more upsetting for a child to have a parent walk away when their child is being abused. But obviously it clearly happens, and it's happened here, and I'm sure it's happened to many, many other children. And that's why this conversation is really important, because we need to help people understand they're not alone. Chris?
So in my family, and my family is very large, so I don't have to be specific, I'm just keeping it general. There was a situation where there was a young person caught in an act of abuse against a young child, and it was immediately spoken about, talked about separately to see what was going on, and it was made very clear that it was inappropriate and it wasn't to continue, and if it did continue, then this action would be taken, i.e. it would be reported to the police. The young child was got help and support, and so was the young person got help and support. So I think, as the girls have said, the quicker you are able to deal with a situation when you come upon it, don't brush it under the carpet, the more help can be given to the whole family to move forward. Because there is a lot of shame, there is a lot of guilt involved in all of this, and there is a lot of damage that can be caused if it is brushed under the carpet and not dealt with at the time.
I find it really upsetting just listening to all of this, and obviously, you know, myself involved in these conversations for years and years and years, and then something just comes in, Denny, and it just gets you, because you just think, you know, I know people walk away from this conversation, that family members walk away, that friends, but a parent to walk away from a child being sexually abused by one of their other children, what is going on, what is going through their head at that time. And obviously we can't second guess that, but that to me this time is just exactly why we're here.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the sentences I've written down quite in bold here is, we can't get away from the fact that if we're wanting parents to be more aware and be able to prevent and protect and be vigilant, we have to allow parents to acknowledge their own relationship with sex. Sex is taboo in this country in many ways, isn't it? And it's around kind of, you know, how do we come in and educate from a school perspective, from a family perspective? And for me, it's about, we haven't touched on it, and I'm just thinking, for me, it's about those busy families where everyone's working and the older sibling takes on a huge amount of responsibility for the younger sibling. Let's not... of course that happens, and of course, you know, in some families that's going to be very healthy, but what an ideal time. How much responsibility do we give older siblings over younger siblings? And we have to be really mindful of that. So for me, it's about, and Chris touched on it, if we bring into our children's lives from day one check-in time every day. How was your day? How are you feeling? What emotions do you feel? What happened today? We make that part of our normal connection, then it's going to be far easier and more seamless to bring in those conversations around. If you've left your older sibling to look after the younger sibling, those conversations happen the next day. Did you watch TV? What program did you watch? Was he kind? Was she kind? You know, that they're not quite so, why are you asking me these questions? They're part of communication within the family.
Parenting. That sounds to me like parenting. And, you know, why aren't more people parenting their children? I don't want to criticize parents, but at the same time, you have to ask, you know, ask why aren't parents having more open conversations? You know, how many parents are walking away from a child, a sibling sexually abusing another sibling in their house? How many people are not doing what Chris says and sitting around and asking questions about how their day's been, what's been going on?
Well, Emma Jane, I think it's important to highlight the fact that we give birth to our children. There's no rule book. We are very parenting from the model that we came from. That's not an excuse, but we only have our own experience of parenting, and thankfully many generational patterns of abuse are severed and stopped. But we have to acknowledge that not everybody has the tools or the knowledge to parent in a way that we know is going to protect and be safe, and so I mean, we've just opened up
another can of worms just near the end of the show. But, you know, and there'll be parents who say, well, I've had all of this and I do parent my children. But actually, are you really digging deep on down on these questions? Okay, look, we're going to take another short break here. And don't go anywhere. I'll be back after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E bargo.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle mice, magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Okay. Okay, welcome back to today's show, The Continued Silence. If you've just joined us, then you're very late, but it will be back on Listen Again on the UK Health Radio's website. Today's conversation is sibling sexual abuse. It's not a comfortable conversation, but it's an important one. For all the reasons that my panel here and my resident panel and my guests have talked about, we need to educate. Parents need to not be in denial. We need to not focus on the bogeyman. We need to, when we're talking about child sex abuse and that it could be someone in your family, it could be a teacher, it could be the friend around the corner, we also need to include that it could be a sibling or step-sibling. And that's a really important message. And of course, again, it's maybe a message that isn't often shared. And, you know, every time I have these conversations, I think, right, I'm going to add that to my list now, because, you know, we need to keep adding these conversations. They're really uncomfortable conversations, but they're really important because they will protect. And I'm hoping that if anyone's listening today, that this conversation has offered you some support. You can find my guests, Denise Corby. You will find her on LinkedIn, Denny Corby. She's there, D-E-N-I-S-E, Corby, C-O-R-B-Y. You can find my resident activist, Chris Tuck, on Twitter. She is at Chris Tuck underscore W-W-H-F. Remind us again what the W-W-H-F is, Chris.
West Wickham Health and Fitness. It's nothing to do with survivors, I'm afraid.
Okay. There you go, a little more plug for her business as well. And then we've got Brooks, at Brooks159Carol. She's on Twitter. And if you go there, you'll find everything you need to know. And Jane Epstein is on Twitter at Jane Epstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N. Look, we are coming up to the end of the show. I'm very aware that, you know, we haven't talked about a couple of things that we should be talking about. So Chris has raised something that I want to raise here, and this is pornography. So pornography at the moment, we know it's huge. Pornhub, I think, has just been taken down from Twitter, hasn't it? Which is a really good thing. So pornography. When I was a kid, it was top of the shelf. And I feel like my mum talking to me about when she was a young girl. You know, when I was a girl, pornography was on the top shelf. And you'd giggle when you walked in the into the newsagent. The boys would giggle and you'd run out because the boys would reach up and grab a copy. And then we know what they were doing. And you know, it was just, it wasn't nice, no. But it was definitely lighter humoured, in my opinion, when I was a child than it is today. And I say that because I work with children. Obviously, we see a lot of action on the social media with these conversations and in the news. Pornography is just hugely accessible. And I don't know who wants to join me for this conversation. Put your hand up if you do. Pornography right now, Jane, you can jump in. Pornography now is easy for every child to get. It doesn't matter how old you are. If you've got a phone, you can get pornography. Now, we need to stop that, right? Because this does not help this conversation when you're talking about bodies changing, hormones, and kids wanting to experiment.
What I will share is it's not if your kids are exposed to pornography, it's when they're exposed to pornography. So again, it goes back into education. I know Defend Young Minds, they have a lot of great resources for talking to your children about pornography, and they've actually got a great book, Good Pictures, Bad Pictures, for younger children and for juniors. And they are saying that, you know, children are exposed to pornography as young as 8. And I have to tell you, I think, you know, Carol and I have heard from a lot of survivors, and so many of them were exposed to pornography. And even those who have reached out to me who are the abusers or caused harm, they say, someone exposed me to pornography and then I acted out. So pornography is a big issue, and I hear it keep coming up again and again. And I do want to mention that Defend Young Minds is also another great resource if a parent has just recently learned about disclosure. They have some step-by-steps, but I'll let someone else talk about pornography. It's a big, scary enterprise, and I don't want to tackle them.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we're coming up to the end of the show, and I don't think we will really give it to the conversation justice, but it's probably a conversation that we will take on from here, children and pornography. Yes, Carol.
Just a very quick last word, Jane. Emma Jane. You just said that children children want to experiment. I think the link with porn is actually we have to accept that children want to have sex. They have a sexual appetite. Their hormones are really high. They want sex. And that's something very difficult that is distasteful for a parent to accept. Children.
I've lost Carol there. She's just gone. Look, we're coming up to the last couple of minutes of today's show. My guests today are Carol Brooks. Carol's key message is sibling sexual abuse devastates families and people's lives. It causes physical and mental health problems to the victims for decades. Living in a home that is unsafe destroys the victim's ability to trust and heal. She also says, if you are a parent, then think you are doing a good job protecting your children, you must consider this truth. Because if you don't, you are running the risk of the biggest possible devastation that could ever happen to your family. Sibling sexual abuse is one of the biggest single risks to your family and children. Jane is the co-founder of both Incest Aware and FiveWays.org. She's an international speaker. She's given a TED talk. She has great experience. So do connect with these two ladies because she wants to educate and empower parents on preventing sibling sexual abuse and trauma in order to help remove the fear of the unknown. A huge, huge show. I'm going to hand over to Denny now to summarize today's show before we leave you this time.
Oh, it's always a tough one, this. And I very quickly wanted to say, for me, porn, exposure, arousal without brain maturation. And that's the difficulty. It's totally exempt from facts or the brain's ability to understand. It's very much around exposure and arousal. So I just wanted to add that. What an amazing show. I mean, for me, the message is it's happening. It happens. No one's exempt. We cannot keep going around thinking that it's happening to another. And for me, it's around set time aside as a parent each day, check in, talk about what they've done, feelings, emotions. When there's babysitters, whether it's family or not, the same conversations. What did you watch? What did you play? How did you feel? Was there kindness? If you have a gut reaction, if you've got a gut reaction, speak to both children involved separately. And if you don't get that kind of resonating message with your gut, keep going, ongoing vigilance, keep coming back to the conversation, stay connected, monitor social media. Gaming's another massive one. Teach them about their own bodies. Don't force our young kids to have hugs with, you know, relatives if they don't feel comfortable. That's a huge part of it. Let them own their bodies. Encourage non-sexist and misogynistic attitudes within the family, model equality, roles and responsibilities. And when disclosure happens, please, please, please believe them.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Denny. I mean, you know, always a great summary. We're coming up for the last few seconds of today's show. Jane is looking for research on this conversation. Is that right, Jane? It's research. People to come in and help you with some research. The website is www.hujisocialwork.co1.qualtrics.com. If you go there, you'll find everything you need to know. I'm sorry to cut this short now, but we are literally coming to the end. I get told off if I go too long. But if you go to speak to Jane and Carol, you'll find them both on Twitter. They are looking for people over 18 years old to come and help them with some research on this conversation. So please do reach out to Jane on that. Look, what a show. Thank you to my resident panel, to Denny, to Chris Tuck, to Denny Corby, to my guest, Jane Epstein, and Carol Brooks. We are trying to normalize difficult conversations. The more we engage, the more normal they become. It's a win-win. Okay, look, thank you to Johan at UK Health Radio, to my panel, to Christine, to everyone else who is working behind the scenes with me here to make this show happen. You're all amazing, and it's great that we can get these conversations out here. Thanks, ladies. I will see everybody next time. Thank you.